This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, last week we learned that Dennis O'Brien, one of Ireland's richest men, the owner of Digicel, was in a bit of trouble. He had a debt that Digicel had to repay by March 1st. They weren't able to do that. And from owning almost all of the company, he was reduced in one fell swoop to around 10%. And maybe even that won't be worth very much. It is a spectacular fall for one of the most successful Irish businessmen. And we're joined now by Richard Curran. Richard presents The Business Show every Saturday morning on RTÉ at 10 o'clock, and it's excellent. And he is a contributor to the Irish Independent as well. Richard, Dennis O'Brien is a phenomenal figure. He has been a robust and very successful figure and a very ambitious one. But for some time now, it's been obvious that Digicel has real problems. Maybe it started when they were going to float on the New York Stock Exchange in 2015. That didn't work because there weren't any takers.
No, I think there was an opportunity for a different outcome, perhaps, if he had have successfully floated in New York in 2015. But he decided to pull the plug on that within 48 hours of going ahead, based on what he saw about the appetite among investors to buy the shares. It's not that there was no appetite. We don't know the details, but it appears most likely that they weren't willing to pay a value for the shares that Dennis O'Brien felt they were worth. And afterwards he said, I'm glad I pulled the plug, because you wouldn't sell your front garden if you thought that it was worth more, or you wouldn't sell it at a discount. So looking back now, there may well have been an opportunity, even if he had accepted a lower valuation at that time, perhaps there might have been a different outcome to this for the company. But I do think, Eamon, though, when were the seeds of this sown? It probably had to do with the whole business model around Digicel, because in one way, it was a fantastic achievement to win a license in Jamaica on the other side of the world and then turn that into a massive mobile phone conglomerate in 25 markets with 13 million customers. But the way that he did that was that he tapped the bond markets for very large amounts of borrowing and debt in order to put in the infrastructure, you know, expand the company. And then the idea is that if the company expands enough and you make enough profits, you're in a position to manage that debt and everybody gets paid off. In this instance, at one stage, the debt peaked at $7 billion. And there were some very good days early on in the company whereby Dennis O'Brien was able to take out dividends between 2005 and about 2015. Of 1.7 billion euros. So he'd already made his money from it. And then you had a business that after 2013 kind of stopped growing in terms of its overall revenue size. It sort of peaked in scale 10 years ago.
Yeah, Haiti was one of his markets and he was a big player. They had a tragedy there, earthquake, I think. and he helped the Haitian government. That was a big market for him. And also that part of the world, Trinidad and Tobago, was another market. So he was exploring markets where the infrastructure didn't exist and the technology didn't really exist. And it was fertile territory for people who were just about to make their first move into mobile phones and later on broadband and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, most of the markets that he went into at the best of times are difficult places to do business, whether it's dealing with government, dealing with administration, dealing with civil servants, just putting up infrastructure, getting things done and making sure, you know, you get paid. And Haiti, you know, one of the poorest countries in the world,
yes,
was always a difficult place to do business. And he had made a go of it. At a time then the earthquake happened, it was devastation. And, you know, he was still heavily involved in rebuilding the country and making money there. But there were two things went against them in Haiti in recent years. One was Digicel owed all of its debts in dollars. And the currency, the gourd in Haiti, was
yes,
falling in value. So all the money that you might make is in the local currency. And that's actually worth less when it comes to paying off dollar debt. And then much more recently, the place descended into social and political chaos. There was the assassination of the president. And right now, two thirds of the capital city is run by armed gangs.
Yes.
And it's very, very difficult to turn that around, to have an election, to do any of these things. So the company said in November that in the 6 months to the end of September, instead of making about $75 million in that 6 months, which they had done the previous year, they would actually be making more like $20 to $25 million. And if anything, that situation has got worse. There are now blockades of fuel getting into Haiti. They need diesel in these generators to give power to the mobile phone mast. So it was always a tricky place to do business. It's now become, I'd say, nearly impossible.
Now, the beginning of Dennis O'Brien goes back about 25 years, 24, perhaps, when he won the contract to have the first mobile phone license in Ireland. It was controversial because the Moriarty Tribunal subsequently investigated the relationship between Dennis O'Brien and the Minister for Energy and Communications at that time, Michael Lowry. Lowry and O'Brien were ultimately vindicated on costs and stuff like that. So nothing conclusive emerged from the Moriarty Tribunal, but it did cast a shadow.
It certainly cast a shadow because the investigation went on for so long. Some of the evidence that was heard, you know, was really kind of quite extraordinary, whether it was on the Michael Lowry side or insights that we got about how Dennis, you know, had run the business and his relationship with his business partners in ESAT Digifone, who were the Norwegian company Telenor.
Yes.
And in the end, the Moriarty Tribunal concluded that the minister had helped to deliver the license. Dennis O'Brien continued right throughout and to this day to say that he was not involved in anything inappropriate in relation to the license. But that was the conclusion of the tribunal, and he has disagreed with the findings of the tribunal. But by winning that license and then turning that mobile phone company, ESAT Digifone, into a huge success, that really bolstered him so that when he sold it in 2000 to BT, he personally would have gained about 250 million euro.
Yes, and one of his big, PJ Mara, the late PJ Mara, who was a good friend of mine and was Charlie Haughey's press secretary, government press secretary, PJ advised O'Brien for many years. And O'Brien's decision to go into media, Richard, in PJ's view, he said he shouldn't have gone into it. And he told O'Brien, you don't like them. He doesn't like journalists. You don't know it. Don't go. But he had a feud with Tony O'Reilly, which led him into the feud was over Aircom, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really it went back.
And it was very bitter.
It was very bitter. Absolutely. The feud really began when both of them went head to head to try and buy Aircom. It was very close in the end, but ultimately Dennis O'Brien's, it's a personal view of mine, Dennis O'Brien's track record in relation to trade unions, because ESAT was a non-trade union house, meant that the Communication Workers Union and their shareholding through the ESOT, or Shareholder Trust, which had about 15% of the company, they were extremely unlikely to back the Dennis O'Brien bid, no matter what it said. But in the end, they backed Tony O'Reilly. Dennis O'Brien lost out in that bid, and the company went on to be financially successful for those new owners. O'Brien felt, firstly, that he'd been hard done by in independent newspapers' coverage of that takeover battle. Yes. And he also felt that independent newspapers he'd been hard done by in the coverage of the Moriarty Tribunal. So, for example, I would have known Dennis O'Brien. I interviewed him several times in the 1990s. He agreed to be interviewed for a book that I was writing in the 1990s on entrepreneurship in Ireland. But when I started covering the Moriarty Tribunal, my relationship with him deteriorated. You know, he phoned me up a number of times to challenge me about what I was writing. He stopped talking to me, refused to shake my hand on a number of occasions. And eventually, throughout that takeover battle over Indo, when I was deputy editor of the Sunday Business Post and still writing about it and writing about the Moriarty Tribunal, he would have written a 14-page letter to the editor contesting my coverage. So that's just a spat that sometimes happens between business people and journalists. But I suppose it puts in context how strongly he felt about what had happened in the coverage of Moriarty and in the Aircom takeover. So he wanted Indo, you know, he wanted to depose O'Reilly's control of Indo and basically be in a controlling position in the company.
Yes, and O'Reilly had always been known how to take care of the unions. Even when I worked there, Richard, he always looked after the unions. He had a union rep on the board, as I'm sure you know, one of the print union guys. And ironically, what Tony O'Reilly did with Aircom, he flipped it really, made a quick buck and ran away.
Yeah.
And it prompted Dennis to want to buy independent newspapers. And that whole exercise over a period of years cost him an estimated $500 million.
Yeah, he started buying up the shares, Eamon, and in a very unusual move, he publicly dissed the company by saying it's badly run, it's not as good a business as people think, it spends too much money on the head office, and he had a whole range of reasons as to why he was sort of trash-talking the business while still then buying shares in the company. So it's kind of like people say, well, if you think it's that rubbish, why are you spending all this money buying shares in it? So he increased the stake as far as he could go, which was 29.9%. And after that, if you buy any more shares than that, you must make an offer for the entire company. O'Reilly could rely on probably about 35% support between his own shareholding, management, and others. So it was really, he'd reached a sort of a, almost like a dead end, because he was going to have to make a bid for the whole company, and people felt that's a huge ask. The valuation on it was enormous. So he was buying shares, spending millions on it. Dermot Desmond invested in the company. He bought about 5 or 6%, and Dermot Desmond took the decision to back Dennis O'Brien on key decisions, and that would have been instrumental in increasing his influence in the business. O'Brien always denied that in any formal sense he had control of it, because he only had 29.9%. But certainly, you know, the chairman was Leslie Buckley, a good friend of his, and he was clearly very influential in the company.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, the move away from Ireland to set up his Digicel, the company to go. He bought a place in Portugal, which is a beautiful place, Quinta do Lago, which is now he's improved it. In fact, it's listed as his home. He did other things, but he founded Digicel. They bought, as we said, in Haiti, or they invested in Trinidad, Tobago, and in places where that weren't really stable. The build up to the 2015 attempt to float on the New York Stock Exchange, I suppose that would have been, would it, Richard, if he'd pulled that off, that would have been a eureka moment in terms of rewards.
Yeah, I mean, he'd already taken out about 1.7 billion euro prior to that in dividends. And this would have been an opportunity. What was on the cards was that he was going to sell 40% of the company. He owned 99% of it at that stage. He was going to sell about 40% of it, and it was going to raise $1.8 billion. Now, he wasn't necessarily going to take that money himself. He was actually going to use it to pay off some of the debt, because yes, at that stage, the debt in the business had ballooned, and they were facing a lot of challenges from competitors in these sort of more peripheral markets. So it's great when you get in first and you're the first ones with a mobile phone license. You can make lots of money. It's all new territory. But then there comes a time when you've got to invest, you know, more in data, more in other services. You've got to improve your infrastructure, and you've got competitors nipping at your heels. So the way to respond to that is to invest. So if he pulled that off, but he made a number of, I mean, and this is totally with the benefit of hindsight on my part, but what appear to have been mistakes. One was, in the run up to that float in 2015, there had been three or four or five flotations had not reached the target share price. So that yes, kind of looked dodgy in terms of the way the market was going. Secondly, he was going to sell 40% and keep 60%, but he wanted 95% of the voting rights. Yes. So in other words, he's saying to people, come and buy 40% of my company, but I don't necessarily need your input in controlling it. I'm going to keep 95%. Investors kind of don't like that when it comes to a company that's already indebted. And then the other issue was, he was going to use some of the money to pay down existing debt. So if I'm an investor, am I going to spend 100, 200 million to invest in a company and my 200 million is going to pay off some of its debts rather than build new masts and go into new markets? So you'd sort of, all of those things had gone against him. And what's really interesting, Eamon, is that when you look back, the growth in the company's revenues had peaked in 2013, 2 years earlier. Yes. If he'd gone in 2013 to the New York stock market, the market was on fire. Yes. It had 2013 was the best year for flotations since 2000, and the market itself had the best stock market performance in 13 years. But the problem was, in 2013, you might say, well, why didn't he go then? he was very busy trying to win a license in Burma, of all places. And Burma, tricky place to do business, as you'd imagine. It's a population of over 50 million. And he may have felt, if we get that license, and that's a 50 million population market, it will really increase the value of the company. So there may have been an element of being distracted by trying to win Burma rather than thinking about floating. I don't know, that's speculation. But in the end, they didn't win the Burma license. The Norwegians, Telenor, won it. And ironically, when they won it, they had a few good years, and then there was the military coup, and they had to take a hit of $700 million on their investment in Myanmar. So it was a lucky escape for O'Brien in that sense.
Now, the thing about him in his general dealings in business is he is extremely determined, very, very hands-on. Even I worked for him at News Talk, and he had opinions about program in independent newspapers, the same thing. It didn't work and he lost a lot of money. The trouble, I suppose, is timing part of the trouble, as you've just illustrated there. Had he sold or attempted to float in 2013, he would have been okay. And the same thing when you look at the locations. Haiti had problems, and Trinidad and Tobago, these places are not, you know, the most stable places. So he's been unlucky, but he's also been very determined and stubborn in terms of his vision of how things should be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's part of his business style and his personality. And, you know, he sort of, you're either with me or you're against me kind of thing. And when it came to Digicel, you know, during the really high growth days, he was able to pay himself money out of the company and take 1.7 billion euro out of it. What that meant was that after that, from about 2013, 2014 on, the real risk was being carried by the bondholders, because if it all went wrong in the morning, kind of difficult for Dennis O'Brien, bit embarrassing, ignominy, but he'd already, you know, bagged 1.7 billion out of that business. So he was really putting the risk on their shoulders. Now, he was never going to give up his ownership and control of this company without a fight. And what he did do was in 2020, he's already done two restructurings on the debt where he negotiated with the bondholders. Initially in 2018, he got them to delay repayments of some of the bonds. In 2020, he convinced them to write off $1.6 billion of their debt. And in return, he didn't give up any of his shareholding. So he clearly drove a very hard bargain with them at that point in time. But things didn't necessarily improve. You know, things began, interest rates started to go up, higher cost of doing business, the dollar went up in value versus the currencies he was operating. So in the last couple of years, these things really started to go against him. Haiti had its own then implosion. So he might have felt, you know, I can see them off in 2020. I can still have ownership of this business. The problem was the equity in the company, because its debts were so huge relative to its assets. What is the value? Or what was the value before this deal of owning Digicel? The shares weren't really worth very much. But now, he might have taken a view, if I try and bat them off again, and I agree to put more money into the company myself, and I try and keep ownership of it, the problem will be, I'll end up working for the bondholders.
Well, that appears to be, and I saw a piece in the Sunday Times suggesting that for the first time in 25 years, he'd be working for someone else, rather than working for himself.
He will, but he won't be, he's going to own about 10% of the company. So the question is really, they're going to have to incentivize him to work very hard for them. And the way to do that will be to agree to give him more shares in the future and maybe bring that up to 20% depending on, you know, the performance. But if he'd put up a fight and held on to 99% of the company, you know, for what? Because they were only going to come calling again. He was going to run into the same difficulties, and he would end up busting a gut as the person who owned the business to make the repayments every quarter or every half year for a load of bondholders. In this scenario, he's only got, you know, 10% of the company, and they're going to have to incentivize him to really drive that forward. And they need him because of his knowledge of the business and his contacts.
Now, he's decided to become a citizen of Portugal. And that's maybe for tax reasons as well. But he is still involved in stuff here. Some of it controversial. The SiteServe business, which is not yet resolved. And he's involved in that. That's it's a result of Anglo-Irish Bank, isn't it?
Yeah, this was a business that he bought from Anglo-Irish Bank, which later became IBRC. And he bought it for a relatively small sum. It had huge debts. And it was quite a big employer. It did a lot of sort of facilities management and infrastructure servicing and so forth. And he has turned it around and it has expanded. And it's a very financially successful company now. He also, around about that time, the time of the crash, he bought into Topaz, the petrol station chain. And yeah, he would have bought into that quite cheaply. And then in 2015, that was sold for about 258 million euros. So he did well out of Topaz. He also has the Beacon Private Hospital,
yes,
which seems to continue to do well. And he would have other interests in property. But on the downside, if you looked at, you know, what did he do with the 1.7 billion euro that he received from Digicel between 05 and 2013 or 14? 500 million, you know, he lost on independent newspapers.
Yes.
He loaned about 150 million to Communicore, which was his radio group. And then
yes,
he had to convert that into equity. And then that was sold for about 100 million. So I don't think he came out ahead on his radio interests. He also spent a lot of money on property in Dublin 4. You know, he spent 35 million on a house in Shrewsbury Road and then said he wanted to flatten it. And he wasn't given permission to level it. So he still has that house. He also bought a site from UCD for, I think it was about 15 million, with a view to building a house on it. But I don't think he did build on it. So he put a lot of money into property in Dublin 4, and he still has those different interests.
Yes. And, he's, you know, he also put a lot of money, people might think, into the FAI and paid for Gianni Trapattoni to come and Roy Keane and Martin O'Neill. He gave the FAI 12 million and helped with the rent for the Aviva and all of that. And in return, he's an honorary vice president of the FAI, which is, I suppose, something that he's also a shareholder in Celtic Football Club. The last question I want to ask you is about these two guys, both of whom we know, Tony O'Reilly and Dennis O'Brien, two titans in a way. They loathed each other, apparently. And they both ended up not being masters of the universe. Is that a fair comment?
Well, certainly I think Dennis O'Brien, his personal wealth is not as great as it was. And he's now lost control in this manner of his biggest business, which was Digicel. And he's taken a few hits along the way, and he's had some gains as well in terms of other interests. But I mean, he's been a controversial figure. I think in Tony O'Reilly's case, Tony O'Reilly, you know, was probably Ireland's first billionaire. And, again, you know, financially, ran into huge difficulty. In his case, I think, the trigger was probably more Waterford Wedgwood and the fact that he actually put several hundred million of his own money into making Waterford Wedgwood work, and it didn't work. And that would have had ripple financial consequences and ripple effects, which left him very heavily indebted. And, you know, he's had his own financial difficulties since then. They're it was an extraordinary clash of the titans.
Yes.
And, you know, in business terms, they're not looking as titanic.
Okay, Richard, we're really grateful to you for joining us on The Stand. Richard Curran is the presenter of the business program on RTE every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. A very, very good program, because business isn't always the sexiest thing. And Richard also contributes to the Irish Independent. We're grateful, Richard, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.